Succession number 28354, Reel 8.
I'm sorry to William, yes, well, you thought that an unlikely possibility.
Yeah, almost certainly the gun, that gun overheated and burst, the shell burst in the barrel like they sometimes did. After that, it was extremely quiet, as far as we were concerned, that day, obviously. We just sat there with a grandstand view of all the Mulberry Harbour coming in and being... The block ships sinking themselves and these great concrete blocks coming in to form the harbour. I was due to go back to Portsmouth to pick up General Dempsey, who was commanding the 21st Army Group, but they changed that. He decided he wanted to go in something bigger. I can't remember what he came in, but not my ship. But I was called back late that night and steamed to Portsmouth. Again, rather exciting because the mass of shipping coming against us. I was the only the only one going north. Everything pouring in south. A mass of shipping in the dark, and went into Portsmouth and fueled, and then went straight on to Sheerness to pick up a convoy to bring round to the beachhead. I don't remember how many days all that took, actually. Not very many, obviously. What I do remember was being more tired than I've ever been in my life before or since, and actually falling asleep on the bridge before I knew what was happening. It was a very quiet day, really, as far as we were concerned. We had none of the dangers and excitements, really, as we'd expected. It was nevertheless very tense and very tiring. Then back in Sheerness, we collected this convoy and took it round. And when going through the Straits of Dover in broad daylight, we were fired on, as you always were, by the guns from Cap Grenet. One had a routine, actually, quite a simple one, which you saw the flash of the gun and you counted. I can't remember what the flight time was, but say it was 60 seconds. You counted up to 60, and then over the loudspeakers said, "Lie down," and everybody in the ship went flat on their bellies. Then you heard the explosion and everybody got up again, because these things did on striking the water, they were apt to shatter with shrapnel rather than be armor piercing. And they were, of course, by the time they got to you there, they were dropping vertically. The parabolic trajectory was over. They were dropping vertically out of the sky.
And you made no attempt, or there was no need to zigzag during the 60 seconds?
Well, no, nothing you could do about it. The thing was in the air. It was like, you didn't know where it was going to land anyway. No, you did nothing at all. Actually, on one convoy, I know, I thought this is awfully silly. The merchant ships can do nothing about it. And I scattered. I just went ahead about a couple of miles and waited for them to come out of the zone, because it seemed too stupid to stay there. But we did actually have my chief engineer artificer wounded on that occasion. He unfortunately was not lying down. He was in the lavatory sitting on the seat, and this thing burst quite close, and a lump of shrapnel came through the ship and went into his kidney. He was quite seriously wounded. So the lying down was a good tactic. Then back at the beachhead, I lost three ships on that convoy. That was sad, because we came into the beachhead at night, and from off the south of the Isle of Wight was darkness all the way to the beach. And there was such an absolute mass of shipping, I had not the least idea which was my convoy and which was somebody else's and which was which belonged to who. And the E-boats got in the middle of us, and I was dashing around with my ship trying to find them and firing star shell, which I stopped doing because I realized all I was doing was illuminating my own ships for the E-boats to see them better. We didn't catch an E-boat, we didn't see one, we lost three ships. I only know we lost three ships because they weren't there when we got there. I didn't really even see it happen. That shows how much in control I was of that convoy. I don't think there was any possible way of being in control of it. There was such a great
How many ships did you start out with?
Oh, I suppose about 30.
30?
About 30, actually, I guess, yes.
And how many escorts?
I don't remember another escort. I dare say there was one. I don't remember. No, it was...
And these E-boats would have come from Calais or Boulogne?
Well, probably from Le Havre.
Le Havre.
Mm. Almost certainly from Le Havre, I should think.
Right.
But... well, they could have come from Cherbourg too, of course, on the other side. I don't know. We then formed part of the sort of defence force of the assault area. We sat around doing very little all day, and at night formed a line off Le Havre, where the Germans were sending band torpedoes and small, the small U-boats, whatever they call the X-craft, or the equivalent, and that was just extremely boring and tiring and unattractive. Bit of warfare, just sitting at anchor, having to be awake all night on your bridge with everything alert at action stations, looking out for these swimmers and things coming in from Le Havre. And they did get in, some of them, because obviously they weren't all seen, but they weren't very successful. But at about that time also, the Germans started using a mine that they'd not previously employed, the pressure mine. They'd had the magnetic mines they dropped, and those were in the beachhead, but the pressure mine was a new one. And there was no means of sweeping this immediately, other than the pressure of a ship doing it and blowing the ship up. So we all had to move around the assault area at 7 knots maximum.
So it was the pressure of your bow wave?
It was just the pressure of the ship itself, on the mine set on the bottom. And the change of pressure of a ship passing over it was what actuated the mine.
That's highly sensitive piece of...
Very sensitive indeed, yes. Very. It causes great inconvenience, and various ships went up on it, including Admiral Vian's flagship HMS Scylla. And actually, we all rather laughed when that happened. We said, so the old bugger right, because we was made to move around the beachhead at only 7 knots, and the battleships weren't even allowed to move. They were towed by tugs at about 1 or 2 knots. Nelson was there, and various other battleships, I remember. And there was a Philip Vian, flag officer of the assault area, dashing around about 20 knots. And sure enough, dashing around to 20 knots,
He hit one
and broke the back of Scylla. She never sailed again. She was completely wrecked. But I suppose he had to get from A to B. He was in charge, so I suppose but it annoyed us. I have no real recollection how long all that went on for, as far as my ship was concerned. But there was all much of the same. I was not there for the gale. I was not there for the gale because, of course, I went to get that convoy. That's right. When we brought the convoy, and that gale had happened and broken up the Mulberry Harbour so seriously. The only other event of interest to me was that my brother came off and had a bath. He's a gunner, and he was in the assault on Caen. And so I saw him and his mates and gave them a wash. After that, in HMS Cottesmore, life really felt very, very dull. We went back on the East Coast and back to the East Coast convoys, which were not a very interesting, much less interesting anyway, thing to do. And in November of 1944, I was relieved of Cottesmore, and I persuaded myself, I got married in 43, and I persuaded myself that I'd been at sea the whole war, and that I was very tired. I therefore deserved a rest. I therefore should go to HMS Royal Alfred, which was the training establishment at Brighton, and I thought they told me that I do. That's what exactly what they do. And then on my birthday in November, I walked into the Admiralty to see the appointments commander, who was Commander St. John Tyrwhitt. And I should have known, as I walked through the door, he said, "Ah, just the chap I'm looking for." I should have known that I'd lost it. And then he then buttered me up by telling me I was to be made an acting lieutenant commander, because the job he was appointing me to, which was staff officer plans of the salt force in Burma, was so important, etc. So bitterly disappointed, I had to go and tell my wife that I was off to India in a fortnight. There were all sorts of jabs you had to have in those days, no doubt. All sorts of jabs you had, no doubt there are now. So I used to have them in succession. In order that my little bit of leave should not be entirely spoilt, I had the whole lot in one. And by God, I was ill that night, but at least in the morning I recovered and I was able to enjoy my leave. And flew out to India. This was Force W. Force W was an assault force, which was then in the process of formation. Obviously hadn't got a staff officer plans yet, because that was me. And it was designed to work the army down the coast of the Arakan in Burma. And we started off in Delhi, only for a short time, flew then to Cox's Bazar in Assam, where we joined up with 15 Indian Corps, I think I've got the number right, 15 Indian Corps, that's right, under General Sir Philip Christensen, and started to plan the capture of Akiab in Cox's Bazar. Cox's Bazar is near Chittagong. From Kandy, Mountbatten's headquarters, came a Captain Goodenough, Royal Navy, who was Mountbatten's sort of chief planning officer. He sat down. He was an extraordinarily clever, intellectually bright man. I thought, not a practical one, but a very brilliant staff officer, obviously. And he dictated to a shorthand typist seven different outline plans for the capture of Akiab. Or not outline plans, you know, sketches of plans for them. And we then wrote seven different outline, or I did, I suppose, with help, outline plans for the capture of this place. And this was awfully stupid, because when the time came actually to do it, we weren't ready for any of them, because you didn't know which the hell you were going to do. It'd be much better to have picked a plan and gone for it. So we planned the capture of Akiab, which was a perfectly straightforward amphibious plan, and I think probably very lucky this all happened. We arrived 3 days late. The Japanese had gone, and the island had been captured by an airman who flew over the airfield and noticed nobody was there and landed. We came along afterwards and did the assault in a peaceful way into the Akiab. My Admiral B.C.S. Martin was the Admiral commanding this outfit, a rear Admiral, and Captain Eric Bush was the Chief of Staff. B.C.S. Martin was the first, I think, ex-lower deck mate to be promoted to flag rank. I may have got that wrong, but certainly it was a remarkable achievement on his part. Unfortunately, I personally don't think it should have happened, because he wasn't a very good admiral. He decided that he would direct from on high, and that his staff should not bother him with details. Unfortunately, in amphibious operation, you start with the detail and work back to the big thing. It's the man in the landing craft, how tall he is and how deep the water is, how many you can get in the landing craft, etc., etc. You go backwards rather than starting with the great idea. Eric Bush, the chief of staff, was a most able and highly decorated officer. He'd won the DSC as a midshipman at Gallipoli, and he had two or three DSOs, which he'd won in HMS Euryalus in Philip Vaughan's cruiser squadron in the Mediterranean. He was also a most experienced amphibious officer, in that he'd been the assault force commander for Sword Beach at Normandy. So he really knew his stuff, and he was a tough little man. And I'd not done a staff course. I hadn't the remotest idea about staff work. And Derek Bush was an extremely good mentor, a very fierce one, actually. But unfortunately, this was a very unhappy outfit. It was unhappy from the word go, because the Admiral was such a difficult character to deal with. I'll come to it, it goes on a bit. We, having taken Achiab, we then planned the capture of Ramree Island, which is the next island further south. And this was a proper assault. We got there before the Japanese had left, and it was a proper amphibious operation, with 26 Indian Division, commanded by one of my most favourite general, I think, I've ever met, General Lomax. I loved him. I thought he was a really wonderful man, Major General Lomax.
Can I just ask what it was about General Lomax then that inspired this in you? What were his qualities?
He was a very good leader, there's no question. That was 36 Indian Division, was an extraordinarily well-run outfit, most efficient. He was just an extremely good commander. Also a lovely personality. I'll tell you a story about him. We were in Ramree after we'd taken the place. He was in a bungalow, which he set up as his headquarters, and he was on the telephone, on a field telephone to his front line somewhere or other, south of, by then well south in the island, and having Greg Dougherty speaking to them, and turned round to tell all the staff to shut up and bloody well keep their mouths shut, because he couldn't hear his brigadier, and went back on the telephone, at which there's a lizard called a tokai, which lives in the eaves and the thatch of tropical houses, and it goes tokai, tokai, and as everybody went silent and Lomax went back on the phone still swearing because he couldn't hear it, this thing quite clearly said fuck you and Lomax picked up the telephone and flung it across the room. So we captured Ramree. There's another good story actually about that, which epitomizes the various commanders. General Sir Philip Christensen, apart from being, I think, a very able general, was an ornithologist of note. And our Commodore, the Earl of Bandon, known as the Abandoned Earl, who commanded 224 Group RAF, was the Air Force commander. He was a great shot. He was well known in any pheasant or other shoot in Ireland, or because it was abandoned, he came from Ireland. And there was Rear Admiral B.C.S. Martin, who had none of these talents. And as the assault force went in, so a great skein of duck lifted up off the beach as the bombardment took place and flew over our head, and General Sir Philip Christensen looked up and said, "Pintail." And the Air Marshal picked up the Air Commodore picked up a sort of imaginary gun to shoot them down, and the Admiral, who honestly didn't know really what was going on ever, I don't think, turned around. He was on the front of the ridge and these two were behind him, having heard the word duck, and he said, "Duck, I never duck," and turned around to face the enemy. It's true. It was the Air Commodore who said duck and raised an imaginary gun, the general who said pintail, as they, and I bet they weren't pincel actually. Anyway, Ramry Islands, we then organised a really rather horrible and disgusting arrangement to kill the Japanese, because they went south in this island, which was all chongs, that's little rivers, water, inlets. They're salt water, they aren't really rivers. They're masses and masses of them. There were more water and mangrove than anything else. And they would, the army had driven them into this, and they wouldn't surrender. And so we blocked, with the landing craft and motor launches and a destroyer, blocked every exit from these things. And really, they were starved to death, and or eaten by crocodiles, or died of malaria, or whatever. It was rather a nasty bit of the war.
But they were invited to surrender, but of
course
didn't.
Yes, so the boats going round with Japanese speakers, with loudspeakers, inviting them to surrender, yeah. Booming away in the chongs.
Any idea how many?
Three, I think there were three surrendered. I remember seeing one of them, the only Japanese prisoner of war I ever saw there. Yeah.
And do you know how many troops
No, I
were?
Don't. I don't. But I think they had quite a lot there. I think it was fairly awful. A fairly awful little bit of the war. No doubt some got away to the mainland, but not very many, I don't think. Now, this having got down there, we then went to... we moved around, we went back to Delhi, and then we came to Burma again, back to Ramry Island, that's right, in order to plan the assault on Rangoon. To start with, we planned it from the island, then we went back to Delhi to join up with whatever the Indian Army Corps or division or was it an army? I can't remember. Which we were to take into Rangoon, and this was interesting. We did the Rangoon planning. We did the Rangoon planning entirely in Ramry Island. Sorry,
that's
and,
right.
And then the assault took place. But fortunately, it had all been started too late, and we were 3 days late there. The Japanese are all gone. So when the assault went into Rangoon, it was a peaceful takeover. I was not there for the assault. I went back to Calcutta in order to organise the follow-on, military follow-on that was to follow the initial assault. But of course, it wasn't necessary because there was no need for a follow-on. So I just sat in the Bengal Club in Calcutta and went to the cinemas. So I found it so hot in Calcutta, the only place tolerable, only air-conditioned place I could find was cinemas. I saw more films in those few days in Calcutta than I care to remember. Then we went to Delhi, this is where I've got this wrong, and started to plan the capture of Malaya, Operation Zipper, a huge operation. And the plan was to land near... On the west coast, obviously, in the Malacca Straits. And the beach selected, or the area selected, was south of Port Swettenham, and it was a beach called the Morib, M-O-R-I-B, the Morib Beach. And the army were determined to land there, because the beach, from air survey, etc., seemed to have good exits. And it was they would be able to open up into the country behind easily. I was a staff officer plans. I wanted the landing craft to land at Port Dickson further south. The reason being, the Port Dickson, although it was a narrower beach, had a very steep gradient, so you could get the landing craft right close in. And the soldiers would hardly get their feet wet, and the tanks would come out onto solid land. Whereas the Morib beach was a flat beach, and it was a muddy beach, and a totally unsuitable one to land not just vehicles, but soldiers, I reckon, because they would beach, the Leningrad would beach so far out that the wretched Gurkhas would be up to their necks in water. There was a great argument about this, and eventually, from a high up, it was ordered that we would land at the Mori beaches. Now, this is really where I reckon my admiral was at most at fault in this time, because it's perfectly evident that those were the wrong beaches, and he should have held out for going to the other one for all the disadvantage it was to the army, or go to both beaches, but certainly not put everything in over that mud. Very interesting that there'll always be witnesses who'll come forward to tell you what you want to hear, like Tony Blair having been told what he wanted to hear about Iraq. In this case, what they wanted to hear was this beach was firm. And there were the people who came forward and said, yes. I can remember talking to one, a Eurasian man, who swore that they'd had motorcycle races on the beach that were so firm. He remembered they dashed around everywhere on it, and you'd never lose a vehicle in it. Quite untrue. The beaches were mud, and the roads, the exits off the beach, which the army wanted to use, were actually floating on the swampy ground around. So I was right, I know, because the vehicles, when we did land there, which we did in peacetime, the vehicles did get bogged down, and it would have been awkward. I don't think it would have made any difference. We had such firepower, and compared to what the Japanese had at that time there, that the assault would have been successful, but it still wasn't the right place.
Can I just ask one question, which comes back to something you touched on earlier? You're doing quite a lot of staff work and staff planning, mm-hmm. yet you've had no training as a staff officer.
No.
And yet the commander of appointments, or whoever he was back in the Admiralty, said, oh, just the man I want.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was it then that caused him to think that I want this man who...
Or he'd just been told the day before, for Christ's sake, quickly, find a bloke. That's, I imagine. yes, I can't think otherwise. Yeah. There was, you know, the Navy didn't really... The Navy was a bit scornful of staff work. It had a scornful attitude towards it. And he probably didn't think it mattered at all. And indeed, when Admiral, you know, Vice Admiral Arthur Power, who was Commander-in-Chief East Indies, we all lined up, and Candy, perhaps it was Colombo, one day when we were down there, and introduced him. And he said to me, have you done the staff course? I said, no. He said, good. So that's an old, slightly old-fashioned approach. I think this was a sort of prejudice. The army, of course, you had to do a staff course to get to the rank of major or the Navy, not that sort of thing. Seagoing is what mattered. I must say I was a bit of that mind. I merely wanted to be at sea. I didn't want to go and do a staff course personally. Where were we? What was more interesting about this particular outfit was that it was a very big assault zipper. I mean, it was a big, big operation. And there were a number of assault force commanders. There were various different assaults that were going to go in, each under an assault force commander who was a captain. And the naval secretary sent out various captains to India while we were planning it to form these different assault forces. And if he'd gone through the naval list to select people who were totally incompatible with one another, he couldn't have done better. I presumed it was accidental. They all hated each other. And as a staff officer, I found myself going between these captains. They were mostly acting captains, actually, commanders. telling them, you know, that Captain so-and-so didn't mean what he said, and trying to mollify them. They were all cross with each other. They were a strange lot. One was a chap called Tizzy Bell, and he put daggers in his... He was a sort of buccaneer, or thought he was, and he was... Don't bother, he was very much don't bother with the detail. He was follow me men, as he pulled his pistol out of his holster. And there was a chap called Johnny Grindle, captain, who'd sadly had gone ashore in HMS Apollo and been court-martialed and had suffered somewhat, been somewhat reprimanded for it, so he was a very unhappy man post-court-martial. He burst into tears various times when he was being... Others were being beastly. There was Captain H.E.G.C. Peachy, who was the epitome of the bad squire, Edwardian... I can just see this man saying, "Don't darken my door again." They were all such an odd lot, and didn't like each other. And the other one was Captain E.T. Cooper, a Springer, Peachy officer, with pop eyes, and a rather hysterical voice. So this was 4W landing in Malaya.